Welcome back. Top of the second hour of today's Road Warrior Radio broadcast this Wednesday, July 29th, 2020. I want to give you the excerpt of the America's Frontline Doctors Summit Session 2 that I mentioned earlier today. Very telling. And, you know, speaking of the, you know, America's Frontline Doctors and the Second Opinion Project, isn't a second opinion intelligent? Think about what is happening. The way that people are captivated by this strong upsurge of power that brings along with it a corresponding uptick in stupidity, as Dietrich Bonhoeffer observed. Historically, a second opinion is an intelligent thing to get. It's wise and prudent. The Bible says a wise man has many counselors. Science tells us, true science and the scientific method tell us that if something is true and right and accurate, then it is strong enough to stand up to scrutiny. That's what the process of peer review is supposed to do. That's what a hypothesis is supposed to do. You disprove it, and if it can be disproven, it's too weak. But if it's real and accurate and right, then the notion is that it can withstand scrutiny. And look at what is happening all around us. Nothing can be criticized. Nothing can be scrutinized. No second opinions can be offered. If you go to the Tea Party Patriots YouTube channel, TP Patriots, you can see some of these second opinion videos that they've done in recent months. And why would these doctors be doing this? Why would pediatricians, you know, MDs and doctors of all varieties and across the country, why would they be putting their reputations and their careers on the line to speak out in opposition to what's happening? How do they benefit by doing that, I wonder? To me, it seems they're honoring their Hippocratic Oath. And they see that harm is being caused, or potential harm, and in some cases real harm is being caused by these measures that are being put in place. It's obvious that something is going on. I mentioned a conversation with the gentleman I had whose wife is a microbiologist, and she said, you know, with no dog in the fight, retired, just, you know, keeping up on things a little bit because it's a part of a way to stay healthy and active mentally, if not otherwise. And she said there's a lot of smoke and mirrors about this stuff. So, but you can't do that, apparently, because on these giant platforms, I'm sure that's what's going to come out of today's congressional hearings, is that, you know, there needs to be a further crackdown. It will be, I suspect, today's congressional proceedings with the tech CEOs testifying before the House Judiciary Committee. It will end up being something along the lines of an Event 201 continuation. How can we flood the zone? How can we make sure that bad information, which is actually good information in this Orwellian inversion, how can they make sure that what they call bad information, which is really good information, like the stuff I'm talking about right now, how can they ensure that this stuff doesn't come out? You know, we need to make sure that people don't get confused and that there is continuity of message and et cetera, et cetera. That's my suspicion. So we'll see. But in the meantime, I want to give you again, Dr. Mobeen Syed's presentation, and you should go watch it for yourself. It's on the Internet Archive. Again, archive.org. You can just search America's Frontline Doctors Summit Session 2, which someone posted a couple of days ago, right, probably immediately after it was I guess it was added yesterday. And then, you know, the original YouTube video link is there in the description. And you can see for yourself that it has been removed for violating YouTube's communitarian guidelines. So everyone should have a voice, YouTube says, I guess, except doctors who present dissenting voices and information to back up their claims. Without further ado, here you go. This is actually the initial remarks that you'll hear are the ophthalmologist, what's his name? Oh gosh, I forget. Dr. Richard Urso, introducing Dr. Mobeen Syed. And so here it is. Go ahead, please.
I've been working with it for 31 years. And one of the things you're going to find out here today is why it works and how it works. And we're going to talk more about how we use it and how not to use it, because we've already been proven how not to use it. Now, to start off the day, I've got Dr. Mobeen, who's one of the best educators in the country. He's a medical doctor. He spent almost the last 4 months doing COVID lectures on many different topics, and he's going to talk to us today about how hydroxychloroquine works at the cellular level. So if I can, I can kick off the talk by turning us over to Dr. Mobeen.
There's a brief silence because his mic wasn't working or something in his screen share. So
I'm going to share my screen and very quickly talk about the mechanism of action of hydroxychloroquine. So look, hydroxychloroquine is a weak base. That is a primary action that we use this drug for in case of malarial infections. What happens is that in case of malarial infection, when we give hydroxychloroquine, hydroxychloroquine enters the malarial plasmodium and goes into its lysosomes. These are, you can think of those as the stomachs of the plasmodium. It enters there, hydroxychloroquine, and reduces the acidity. So as it is a weak base, the stomach of the plasmodium needs acidic environment to be able to digest the food particles it is eating. And when hydroxychloroquine is present and it makes it all less acidic, then that stomach of the plasmodium stops working, and that causes the plasmodium to die. This is a similar mechanism that we use in case of the COVID-19 as well. So let's very quickly see how our cells and how our hydroxychloroquine works within our cells to help us be protected from the coronavirus. And this is possible with other viruses as well. So here, let's say this is our cell, and this is the nucleus of the cell. What happens is that the coronavirus, I think we all know that it binds to ACE2. We call it receptor. It is actually an enzyme present on the surface of our cells. But we call it a receptor because it allows the coronavirus to bind. So let's say here we have a coronavirus. Coronaviruses have spike proteins on them. These spike proteins, or S proteins, are the ones that they use to bind with our ACE2 receptors on our cells. Once they have bound there, then what happens is that there is a thing we say that priming of the S protein occurs. That means that the S protein with one of our enzymes is broken down into two components, and then one component holds on here, the other component binds with our cell membrane, and then this virus starts fusing with the cell membrane. So if I can make it over here, let's say this would start fusing here. So this is the virus envelope now that has fused with our cell membrane. The result of that is that the RNA present in the virus would then be transferred into our cell. Once the RNA of the virus is in our cell, we call it messenger RNA because of its orientation. Once it is inside our cell, this RNA would start helping make more viruses. Now, check this out. This is such a beautiful mechanism. Once the hydroxychloroquine enters our cells, it causes the cellular environment to become less acidic. Most of, especially in the endosomes and in the Golgi apparatus. If you're a medical professional, you will know that Golgi apparatuses are necessary for the virus to then eject from our cells. Similarly, endoplasmic reticulums are small structures here that help make the virus. So generally, we can say that intracellular machineries that are being used by the virus now, these machineries, in the presence of the hydroxychloroquine, will become less acidic. Because hydroxychloroquine is basic in nature, because it is alkaline in nature, it reduces the acidity inside the cell. That reduction in acidity does the following things. Number one, this fusion of the virus envelope with our membrane to then allow its RNA to come arrive into the cell, this fusion is hindered. This fusion requires acidic environment inside the cell. And in the presence of hydroxychloroquine, because the environment inside the cell has become less acidic, the fusion becomes hindered. So that is one mechanism. Second mechanism is, and I want to make sure that we are aware of this, that it's not just that the hydroxychloroquine is a zinc ionophore. These are extra functions or mechanisms by which it helps. So the second mechanism is that when the hydroxychloroquine is present and the environment is alkaline, now the virus has an enzyme called RDRP, RNA-dependent RNA polymerase. This enzyme is the one that would help the virus make its copies. And alkaline environment is bad for this enzyme as well. All of the cellular machinery needs acidic environment. So the second issue that occurs for coronavirus in the presence of HCQ is that the RDRP cannot function correctly. And that is another mechanism by which hydroxychloroquine stalls or slows down the virus replication. Number three, the inside of the these lysosomes and the Golgi apparatuses or the endosomes, the machineries, inside there, the virus has its particles that are generated. So remember, coronaviruses they cannot normally divide. They are not living cells with the division and the nucleus machinery. They are RNAs. So they need to be, their small components are made separately, just like a car is manufactured in separate components and then we put them together. Similarly, the virus components are made separately in the cell and then they are put together in the Golgi apparatuses. And Golgi apparatuses would also require acidic environment. And when the hydroxychloroquine is present, the Golgi apparatus and the endoplasms cannot work correctly. And the result is so they cannot work. Sorry, I was looking at the comments. There was some comment about the video. So now that the endoplasmic reticulums are not able to work correctly, that means the assembly of the virus cannot occur correctly as well, or cannot occur. So virus assembly is stalled as well. So that is the third mechanism. A fourth mechanism is that hydroxychloroquine acts as a zinc ionophore. Zinc is a charged particle. It has two plus charges on it. And charged particles cannot cross our cell membranes and go into the cell because our cell membrane is neutral and it would not allow the charged particles to cross from here. So we need some sort of a channel through which the zinc can go in. And if the zinc enters the cell, then the zinc can attack the virus enzyme RDRP as well and stall its function, which is sort of an antiviral effect of zinc. But this effect would only occur if zinc can enter the cell. So hydroxychloroquine, the next mechanism of action is that hydroxychloroquine would act as a zinc ionophore. And once it acts as a zinc ionophore, it gets inserted in the cell membranes as a channel and allows the zinc to come into the cell. And once the zinc is inside, it would go independent of the hydroxychloroquine and work on RDRP enzyme and stall the viral replication. A fifth mechanism, which is also very interesting, I love this mechanism. What happens is that these ACE2 enzymes, when these are produced, remember the ACE2 enzymes we just talked about? These are the enzymes that act as a receptor for the coronavirus. When these enzymes are being formed inside the cell, I call them, we give these enzymes a candy to then go and do their function. So when these enzymes are formed, the last amino acid on the enzyme needs glycation. What does that mean? That means that we take a glucose molecule and we attach it to the ACE2 receptor or the enzyme, and that completes the enzyme. Hydroxychloroquine interferes with the last amino acid glycation of the ACE2 receptors. The result of that is that when the ACE2 appears on our cell's surface, it has a slightly different shape compared to the regular ACE2 enzymes, because one glycated amino acid is not glycated. The result of that is that when coronavirus S protein tries to bind, so let's say this is the coronavirus again here, and the S protein is here, when it tries to bind with this modified ACE2, the affinity of binding is not strong enough, and it kind of slips out. So that is the fifth mechanism. So if you now look at it, on one end, hydroxychloroquine would not allow an efficient binding of the coronavirus with our cells. Secondly, it would not allow the coronavirus to fuse with our cell membrane to allow its cargo, that is RNA, to enter the cell. Thirdly, if the RNA has entered the cell, the hydroxychloroquine has made the whole environment less acidic, which stalls the cell's activity. Then it is a zinc ionophore. So these are the mechanisms by which hydroxychloroquine stalls and stops the replication of the virus. And this is how it slows down the virus. And this is why it is also important that hydroxychloroquine is that I have for you today.
So that was, you know, long form content. And like I say, these days, it seems like everything is long form content, but I think it's extremely insightful and helpful. I mean, when have you heard exactly how hydroxychloroquine works? But more importantly, the mRNA aspect of what Dr. Mobeen Syed was sharing there really, I think, speaks to the virus antivirus conversation. Stick around. We'll be right back after this short break.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel. With all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, No Child Left Behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing: knowledge. And knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives? Like public broadcasting, we are now finding we can only survive with listener support. Censorship, advertisers being attacked, truth itself being attacked. It's the only way through this. We at Republic Broadcasting humbly ask you to become a supporter. Look at your budget and make a determination of what Republic Broadcasting is worth to you and what you can afford on a monthly basis. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and pledge 20, 30, 40, 50, if possible, 100 a month or more if it's affordable. Click the donate button and become a regular monthly donor. Assure both us and yourself that Republic Broadcasting truth will continue to flow like that morning coffee. The network thanks you.
Foster some discussion, because what has happened is obviously we have been moved in the direction of idiocracy. We're supposed to all act like petulant little victim psychopaths who celebrate one another's victimhood, and the feudalist conflict is to see who is the greatest victim. So again, it's kind of a Fight Club meets the Hunger Games kind of scenario. And I'm hoping that we can step back and take a more objective assessment. And so to the folks who would ask the question, you know, why aren't these people wearing a mask? I would first, as I said, the place that you have to start is in acknowledging the possibility that maybe these experts that are being paraded in front of you, for example, are not, you know, maybe there's more here than meets the eye. Why, again, why, if we have hundreds of doctors, hundreds, more than 1,000 actually, who have joined together and said, we are experts too, and this doesn't seem to square with what we understand based on our expertise. So why are we not listening to those folks? Why is there such an effort to drown out the voices of other experts, dissenting experts? So is it possible, and someone might say, well, why would anyone do that? You know, there are several nuanced aspects of that discussion. How could that be possible? Why would someone do that? As to the why, there are bigger reasons, I would say, but, and again, that gets to the Malthusian eugenics aspect, I would say. I mean, the Georgia Guidestones spell it out pretty clearly. And it seems that this, you know, not only is the coronavirus, the COVID-19 strain, SARS-CoV-2, politically motivated, it seems, but it's also a eugenicist sort of coronavirus because it, you know, attacks elderly folks in nursing home facilities and, you know, indigent folks and things like that. So it's an interesting phenomenon there, but that's a little facetious. But seriously, as far as motive, you know, why would anybody do this? Billions and billions and billions of dollars have already been raised, and trillions of dollars stand to be made on a vaccine that many of these so-called experts that are being paraded before us say will have to be regular, maybe seasonal. You have to get one every 6 months, 6 to 12 months, something like that. So as Bill Gates said, you know, everyone will have to be, you know, everyone on the planet, that's like 7 billion people, he said. And Ursula von der Leyen, you know, we played that clip of her interview where she said, a doctor said zillions of doses, and it's not because her English is poor. So could we not all agree that, you know, trillions of dollars are influential? When you stand to make trillions of dollars, you know, and for those who don't know, people might say, well, Bill Gates has donated a bunch of money, and that's, you know, the Gates Foundation donates, they make grants and whatever. And I say, yeah, but remember a couple of years ago at the World Economic Forum Squawk Box interview, remember when he said that they've received a 20-fold return on the vaccine investments? That's what he said, Bill Gates himself. A 20-fold return. It's been more profitable than just about anything else, he said. Vaccine and peripheral research and development is obscenely profitable, according to Bill Gates himself. Is that not a motive? For those who don't know, go look into the Gates Foundation. Do you wonder if they're giving all this money away, how they have more money now than when they started? Kind of an interesting phenomenon, isn't it? If you gave away all of your money, would you have more at the end of your giving away than when you started? We need to probably define terms. Stick around. I'll be right back.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Extendovite really works. Here are some reviews from Amazon.com. Nikki, great product. Have to try it for a few months to see results. After taking Extendovite for about 6 months, I have noticed improvement on the numbness of my hands and wrists from carpal tunnel. I will continue to buy the product. Ken Peaks, 5 out of 5 stars. Works as advertised. This formula is very powerful. Be careful to follow directions. I am feeling much better. My heart rate and blood pressure has stabilized, and my lower edema has reduced. Lower leg pain due to blood clots has disappeared. Thank you. To order, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822, or visit our website at heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
What would you say if I told you we have a new tool that will increase production and lower maintenance costs for your meat processing company? And it would pay for itself in just 6 weeks.
When pigs fly!
The new Ease-Off Model EZ4 replaces old spring-style carcass droppers and is faster, safer, and more reliable. The Ease-Off lowers or lifts 1,000 pounds to or from your rail automatically using our remote control.
Sounds expensive. Can I afford it?
Can you afford not to try the Ease-Off? It installs fast with just 3 bolts in place of your current dropper. The effortless operation will reduce fatigue and injuries, speed up your line, eliminate downtime, and increase profit.
How can I order my Ease-Off?
Go to EaseOff.com, EazeOff.com, and hurry, because we are offering $200 off on the new EZ4 for a limited time. EaseOff.com. We make pigs fly. Cows, too. Ease-Off LLC, Summersville, Missouri, 417-932-6419.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Encourage folks to watch and share the video that I mentioned earlier, America's Frontline Doctors Summit Session 2. And I think we'll play another little excerpt from it. I think I know what got it bounced off of YouTube for communitarian guidelines violation. But it's interesting. You know, I mentioned some of the other videos that the Tea Party Patriots have posted on YouTube recently, including the Second Opinion Project videos. And I think it's lamentable that most of those videos have actually double-digit or triple-digit views. And there are so many people who are saying, you know, this is an outrage. How can this be happening? But, you know, you have doctors, you have medical professionals who have put their livelihood, their career, their reputation on the line to speak out in opposition and offer their own expertise and say, this doesn't make any sense. So why aren't these videos being viewed and shared widely? Obviously, the YouTube algorithm is not going to help people with that. You know, I'm looking at these, some of them, 18 views, 116 views, 76 views. I mean, these are doctors saying this doesn't make sense. 87 views, 587 views. That should be 587 million. They should be shared widely. That's all I'll say about that. Here's a little bit more from the America's Frontline Doctors Summit Session 2. There's a lot that you should listen to, but at least in my humble opinion, there are visual aids in this as well. So the video is very helpful, but you'll get some of that from the audio. So here's a little bit more from that session, Session 2. Go ahead, please.
Chart that I think I'm sure you've all seen. This is the most commonly used dashboard produced by Johns Hopkins, and probably most of us in this room look at this thing several times a day, and you can get any country and how many deaths they have and that sort of thing. Well, this is another graph produced by Hopkins as well, and I don't think people see it as much. At least I don't see it on the news. And what you see up there in the purple is the United States having the most deaths, and this is current data. You can see down at the bottom it goes, you know, into July. This is current data. So the United States has the most deaths in the purple, and down here the lowest in the white is India. But the thing is, India has what, 1.4 billion people? It's like four times as big as the United States. So when you correct that for population, India is even lower. I mean, this is dramatic. So when you correct for population, a couple countries are higher than the United States. On, and this is the best way to look at the data, is deaths per million people. And a couple countries actually are higher than the United States, and countries are lower, and India is way down there. So a lot of people started looking at India, and you've heard this come up several times. And that's how we first started to think about this. What's going on there? But I think India is complicated. It's huge, but it has a history of chloroquine that goes back to 1800. They're supposedly the world's largest manufacturer of hydroxychloroquine, and they've been using it. I'm not the expert on how much they're using it. Maybe other people know much. They're using it some. I don't know how much. They're using it for prophylaxis some. I don't know exactly how much. So it's tough to figure out what this India number means. So I looked at that, and one thing I knew about India with all this hydroxychloroquine is there's malaria there, and there's malaria in other nearby countries as well. But there, it's not the, like the malaria center of the world. So I started to ask, is there a connection? And Dr. Emanuel has alluded to this as well. There is a connection between malaria and the treatment of malaria and the treatment of coronavirus. And so we started looking at the other countries that have more malaria. And that's what got me thinking and what led to the paper I printed. As it's long been used to treat malaria. We know India has it. But other countries actually have better outcomes than malaria. There are a lot of other small countries that weren't on that graph, and you're going to see in just a second, their numbers were way down, even lower than India. And they're just phenomenal. And so I looked at these six countries, and I picked these six countries because they're reported to be the six most malaria endemic countries in the United States. Wow. Excuse me, in the world, yes, thank you. The six highest malaria endemic countries, and they are Nigeria, Uganda, Mozambique, Ivory Coast, Niger, and Democratic Republic of Congo. So we decided to look at these and see what we could learn from that. And this is this is why we picked them. They have more than half of all the malaria in the world from just these six countries. And so we thought maybe, well, this will help. We'll get some more information from this. It turns out that these six countries have far better outcomes than India. And you saw in that first graph that India was so much better than most industrialized countries. So we looked at these countries to see if we could understand this and see what was going on. And so overall, this looked at 2.4 billion people worldwide. This is public data. This comes from Hopkins for the most part. And we looked at these countries, and what we found is that these six poor malaria-endemic countries had fatality rates less than 1% of the United States and the industrialized West, which was actually Spain and Italy at the time. We found a very wide disparity in these death rates, these death rates per million population. And so two orders of magnitude means more than 100 times. And so just let that sink in for a minute. There's almost nothing else in science and in mortality rates where you're looking at a difference and it's more than 100-fold difference. Usually it's 10 or 20%, and you're trying to figure out if the study's big enough that you can really learn anything from it. But this difference in these death rates was 200 times, 400 times, 600 times. It was more than 100 times. And we're going to see graphs here in a second. And this disparity in these death rates is counterintuitive. It's backwards. It doesn't make sense. And all of you, if you're hearing this for the first time, you're thinking, how could it possibly be that those countries where they're so poor and so overcrowded and stuff like that, how can it possibly be they have lower death rates than the United States and the West? And so a lot of people just don't believe that data. And, you know, that's okay. But we've got Johns Hopkins putting this data out every single day, and we believe their data. So how can we sit? How can a person sit there and go, well, I just don't like that data. It doesn't fit in with my preconceptions. That's not science. So if there's anyone that's not doing science, it's people that hear data and look at data and say, I don't know how to understand that, so I just disbelieve it. So actually, here's the raw numbers. And so I looked at, actually in the original paper, I looked at India, Bangladesh, and Pakistan as well, but I left that out for simplicity here. So you look at the numbers in the United States and Spain and Italy and the six malaria endemic countries. And so we have the total population, you have the total deaths in the country, you have the death rate calculated as a percentage, and then you have the death rate converted to death per million because you have to convert for population. And so the average at the time, at the end of April, beginning of May, the average we can do the math, but for the United States, let's talk about the United States right now. At that time, of the first article, it was 138 deaths per million. It's gotten worse since then, and you heard people talk about these numbers throughout the day here. A couple people have mentioned these deaths per million. It's about 450 now in the United States. And the number, the average number of deaths per million in those six sub-Saharan African countries is 0.3. So one person died out of every 3 million people in those countries. And in the United States, it was 138 or 461 out of 3 million. These are phenomenal numbers. No one's telling you about these numbers. What's going on in the world with these death rates? And there's the math. So I know it's hard to do math at a meeting like this or over the internet, but that's the same thing we just saw in the other graph. United States, in the original paper, it's 138 deaths per million. Sub-Saharan Africa was 0.3 deaths per million. It's a ratio. So the death rate in the United States was 460 times greater than these countries in Sub-Saharan Africa. This data was collected 2 months into the pandemic. And actually, so people come up with a lot of different things. Well, maybe they don't measure the data. Maybe they're lying to us about the data. Maybe they're reporting inaccurately. Maybe people just didn't go there. And we're going to talk about that in just a second. So people, hardly anyone thinks about this and talks about it. And when they do, they usually they make up their own excuses. The fact is, one of the ways I got started about this, I had a trip planned to Africa. I was going to go the first week in March. So in February, I was looking at what's going on in Africa every day. My trip got canceled. And it was good because if I would have gone, I would have got stuck over there and I wouldn't be able to get back. So that's how I got to be looking at what was going on in Africa. The pandemic started in Nigeria 3 or 4 days. The first index case got to Lagos, Nigeria, about 3 or 4 days before the first index case got to New York City. It actually started at the same time or even a couple days before. Now, here's a graphical representation of what we just talked about. So on the left, you have Italy, Spain, and the United States. And if you remember about that time, late April, early May, things were absolutely catastrophic in Italy and Spain, and not as bad yet in the United States. They got worse after that. And so there, here's these numbers just in graphical form. The numbers for Italy, Spain, and the United States, 411, 465, 138. And these numbers, they're essentially zero in these other countries. They're not reporting any deaths at all. And the infection rates are way, way down, too. When you talk about infection rates, the reason I don't talk about it is because you have to start talking about testing and how many people are tested and how accurate they are and a bunch of stuff like that. It gets confusing. But I think Dr. Simone, you said, and Dr. Emmanuel as well, dead is dead. And when you're dead in almost any country in the world, they should be able to figure out if you died from coronavirus or something else. So these numbers are infinitesimally small in all six of these countries. And again, if somebody's putting out false information, are all six countries putting out false information? Have the six countries conspired together to put out false information? Yeah.
Why is that? I mean, the bottom line.
We're going to get there.
Okay.
We're going to get there. That's what we're about here. Yeah.
Okay,
and that's the paper I published. And I looked at the data again in preparation for this conference. Okay, it hasn't changed all that much. The graph looks pretty much the same. This is data just a couple days ago. Again, the United States is a lot closer to Italy and Spain now. And now you're starting to see just a little blip. Okay, it's not 0.3 anymore in the African countries. Its average is about 2.5 per million in all the African countries. But it's in the hundreds in the Western countries. So it's still several hundred times worse in the industrialized West than in these countries. So it hasn't changed much at all. Now, this is just another graph saying the same thing. What I did in this graph, I changed the scale so you could actually see the other countries a little bit. And if you'll notice, the United States is literally way off the scale. It wouldn't go just to the ceiling. It would go to about the fourth story of this building if that scale was extended all the way out to see where the United States data is. And again, in the African countries, it's about 2.5, and ours is 438 when I measured it. So around 450, some people have said. So we see the best outcomes. What are the best practices? How'd they get there? And the answer, I believe, and if someone's got a better answer, fine, let them come up with a better answer. I think the answer is this. The hypothesis is this, is coronavirus always starts in a country because the country is seeded by visitors from outside the country. We know it started in Wuhan, China. It spread maybe to the West Coast from China. It spread to New York and the East Coast from China through Europe and basically came from Europe. And they did some DNA testing and found that out, that most of our cases in New York came from Europe, and they studied where all these flights came from, and there was really never any doubt that all these cases were seeded. People brought the infections in from other countries. They did a study at Hopkins, and it's interesting. Hopkins used their publicly available data, just like I did, and they studied and found out that there was a whole bunch of seeding, they thought, from travelers from other countries went to Africa. And if you look back at the articles that were published in March in that time frame, everyone thought it was going to be absolutely catastrophic in Africa. Everyone thought it was going to be far worse. And that's what we think about disease. If you have less money, if you have more poverty, if you have crowded conditions, if you have minorities, all those things lead supposedly to the disease skyrocketing. And yet all these African countries had all those characteristics and their numbers are so much lower. So even though the experts from Hopkins Public Health said there were all these flights going in and we think there was all this seeding going on, again, that didn't materialize in terms of deaths in these countries. And we know that also people came from China. People came from Europe. People have been coming to Africa from Europe forever. We had this thing called colonialism. You know, remember, anybody remember that? You know, people from Europe been going to Africa back and forth for a couple hundred years. But they've been going from China as well. So there's estimated to be 850,000 patients from China to Africa per year. And most of them go through Ethiopia, but a lot of other countries as well. The picture on the upper left is some kind of ceremonial picture. I believe it's in Kenya, and it's China Southern Airlines and just kind of celebrating how we have these flights from China. And a couple quotes. Africa was believed to be at risk of severe coronavirus infection because 2 million Chinese nationals live and work in Africa. And then up here, because of steady traffic to and from China, experts worry that the epidemic could overrun already strained health systems. So all the so-called experts were saying there was going to be just this catastrophic infection in China, and it was going to hit China worse than anyone else. This picture on the lower right is an actual photograph from February 26, 2020. That was, you may not remember the dates exactly. President Trump halted flights from China at the end of January, January 31st. So this is almost a month later. This flight came in full of Chinese folks from China into Nairobi. And the reason I knew that is because I was planning to fly to Nairobi a week later. And this caused a huge uproar among the Kenyan people. And they immediately took it to the Kenyan Supreme Court and got a ruling to stop flights from China after this flight on the 26th. So my point about this stuff is people were coming from China to Africa. They would have been expected to have this seeding process going on, and yet we still don't see these deaths. What's different? What's different about people coming to New York as opposed to people coming to Africa? And the difference is almost 100% of those people that go to sub-Saharan Africa are taking anti-malarial prophylaxis. They're taking hydroxychloroquine or a newer cousin of hydroxychloroquine. They're taking one of these anti-malarial drugs to go to sub-Saharan Africa. People that are traveling to New York are not taking those drugs. And so what you see, what I believe you see, is what we call a crossover effect. And Dr. Emanuel began to introduce this just based on her past and her history. She has a personal history and a family history that goes back and involves malaria in her home country and stuff like that. And she knew of these drugs, and she's kind of alluded to the same thing that we're talking about right now. So the World Health Organization and the CDC recommend prophylaxis to all travelers to sub-Saharan Africa. So you think, well, do they do it? Do they really do it? It turns out, yeah, they probably do. And again, this is just the CDC recommendation. Okay. And it turns out that 20 years ago, they did a study in the Journal of Malaria, and they found that 95% of the people going to these countries aren't taking their drugs like they're supposed to. It may have slipped a little bit, but it's probably still something in the realm of 90%. Okay, so we know that the disease originated in China. We know that it's transferred from one country to another by seeding. We know that the people going into sub-Saharan Africa are taking hydroxychloroquine or a similar drug, and so it is believed that this massive disparity rate in these deaths is due to the fact that these countries just weren't seeded like other countries were, that the people traveling in just simply were not carrying the coronavirus in. They're still going to get, they'll probably go up, they'll get some person-to-person transmission, but I don't think there's a better explanation, and that's the point of this talk. If somebody has a better explanation.
Dr. Jeff Mitchell saying, like he said there, if someone has a better explanation, please offer it. Doesn't that make sense? And how else would that be explained, what he just explained? And he's commingling terms a little bit there to try to keep the pace going. But if you watch the visual aids, you watch the video, you can see where he makes those slips and what he intended to say. But think also about what's happening in America. I've commented and I've mentioned talking to several folks in several different states who talk about people in America traveling to different states all over the place. And so some of these, you know, now we're starting to see a spread all over America. And are people taking anti-malarial prophylaxis, as Dr. Jeff Mitchell pointed out? Of course, the answer is no, especially when it comes to hydroxychloroquine. Why would the establishment position be that we need to shut down hydroxychloroquine production and availability in America with regard to the coronavirus outbreak, alleged, when what Dr. Jeff Mitchell said seems to be the case? Why wouldn't that be examined further? And I'm pretty sure this is what got the video, maybe among other things, this is probably what got it pulled for violating communitarian guidelines. We're not marinating in our victim psychopathy here. We're talking about real evidence to support a real hypothesis, to support a real effort to put a stop to this, instead of, you know, all becoming victims and figuring out how we can all be better victims together and buttressing a false narrative. So, Dr. Jeff Mitchell, MD, JD, University of Toledo College of Medicine. So they asked the question, posed the question, how can we end this pandemic? Like other medical challenges, best outcomes, best practices. It was kind of his introductory slide in his presentation. And when you're talking about ending the pandemic and not making billions and trillions of dollars, I mean, come on. Doesn't that at least open the possibility that maybe something is going on here more than meets the eye for the folks who are just gobbling up the pedestrian view of the establishment narrative? For whatever it's worth, I hope it was informative. Again, that was America's Frontline Doctors Summit Session 2, Dr. Jeff Mitchell in particular at the end there. I hope it was informative. As always, it truly is an honor and a pleasure. Take care. God bless. And we'll catch you on the other side.
Did you know that you can be tracked and traced when you're online? With identity theft and cybercrimes on the rise, your passwords, your identity, and even your physical location can be revealed to complete strangers. Would you like to surf the internet anonymously and not have to worry about these threats? Well, now you can by visiting patriotinternet.com. For about $2 per month, patriotinternet.com will conceal your IP address and your physical location, allowing you to browse the web, send emails, and instant message anonymously. Patriotinternet.com will bypass filters, block sites, and keyword blocking. You can also bypass logging by your router and your ISP. With PatriotInternet.com, there is no software to install and uses 128-bit encryption for your protection. When using wireless hotspots, PatriotInternet.com shields your information from identity thieves and is compatible with Windows, Mac, and Linux. Protect your identity and your freedom with anonymous internet access from PatriotInternet.com. Visit PatriotInternet.com today.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.